Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 31, titled The Heart Sutra, Part 1.
And actually, it's not that different. There's been a big fuss made in history about the Buddhist-Hindu argument about Atma and Anatma. And it's kind of a dumb argument because neti-neti, right? You all know about neti-neti, you all yogis. In the Upanishads, neti-neti, which means na-iti, 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 that means no, no, no. And that means that all of the sort of habitual identities that people think they are is not the self. Then there is some sort of thing that's beyond everything, that's the self. Okay, fine, it's a kind of nirvana, satchitananda, whatever. But apparently that's not the ordinary self, or apparently it might be. But it certainly isn't experienced in the ordinary sense of a personal thing, you know. Because when you have your Paramatma, you're God. So it's not you personally. And also anybody else who realizes the Paramatma, they're God. So it's not them personally. And since God is all of you, it's not even him personally. Poor guy. So it's sort of like nirvana, but it's like nirvana really, more or less. So anyway.
I've got some yes? questions now.
Yes.
Do you mind?
Oh, it's Lisa, of course. But not yet. You have to hold it, okay? Make a note of your question.
Okay.
And not yet, not yet. We're finishing this thing, just the different points of it, okay? So then, Shariputra asks him. Then one thing to note, Shariputra is the head monk, and he's considered enlightened in a dualistic manner. That is to say, he has had a taste of nirvana, but he thinks that's nirvana. And then he thinks he's back in his body for the remainder duration of his life, just out of habit energy. He has no attachment to it anymore. He'd rather be in nirvana. But he's kind of hanging out with the Buddha and helping people and helping others find this release place that he feels he found. And he'll go back there when he dies and then be there forever, he thinks. Although when he's an actor in the Mahayana texts, he's kind of constantly being disillusioned about this and being a little bit hammered with non-duality. Like here he is by Avalokiteshvara, who's a Mahayana Bodhisattva. But therefore he asks the Bodhisattva the question, and actually Buddha makes him do it. Because Buddha, by the power of Buddha, means telepathically, Buddha pushes him to do this because he becomes the interlocutor, which then elicits the teaching. If you follow me, and Buddha himself is in trance. He's in the illumination of the profound trance samadhi. You know. So then he says, and notice he says, "Noble son." He's only thinking of males there, because he's a chauvinist. Sorry, Buddha. He's a Brahmin, you know, male Brahmin. So anyway, how does he? But he's into a profound transcendence of wisdom. That's good. He feels he's known as foremost of the wise himself, and so he. But he has a wisdom that makes him think he can disappear from the universe. But anyway, he asks anyway. Then Avalokiteshvara answers, and notice Avalokiteshvara says, "Son or daughter." That's like a new non-duality Mahayana kind of little sub note. You know, he specifically says, "Noble son or noble daughter." Then he goes on. And then he starts listing all the categories that the meditators use to try to find, you know, to go with their sense of self, the habitual sense of self that we have, we all have who are not fully enlightened, which is that it's a real thing in there somewhere that I have. That's really me. It's always me. It's been me. It will be me. It's my real me. And so these are all categories of ways of looking for that. So then he does this thing. So should those five body-mind processes should be truly realized to be void of any intrinsic reality? We went through the five processes, right? So then he mentions the first one, which is matter, rupa. So matter is voidness. Now that's very far out, if you understand that. Because, you know, we have for example, our scientific people tell us that this wood, this solid wood and my hand pounding on it, are made of atoms. And atoms are mostly empty space. There's a tiny little thing, a nucleus, called an electron, and then a nucleus, and then there's an electron zapping around like a mosquito in in the bleachers of Yankee Stadium, and the little like little nucleuses on, yeah, on to home plate, and the rest of it's all empty. And that's the reality of this here. And so we have a kind of illusion that this is a solid thing, because I guess whatever the motion of those atoms, of those electrons, whatever, they create the illusion in our sensorium of solid matter. But we have therefore two ideas, and we think those scientists know better than us, don't we? Ours is just a ordinary coarse senses, and they have high instruments of measurement, and they say this floor is mostly empty, right? And so we have like that, but then when you say emptiness is matter, and then that means that it's not that the nucleus is just as empty as the space inside that. The electron is just as empty as it. So it's not that emptiness is not like nothingness, in other words. It's not empty space. Empty space is kind of an analogy for it. But what emptiness is the fact that the nucleus has nothing non-relative in it. It's empty of an intrinsic nucleus hood, something like that. There's no indivisible, analysis-resistant, you know, absolute thing that makes the atom the atom. Do you follow me? An intrinsic reality, an intrinsic identity, an intrinsic objectivity. They have a lot of language like that in their analytic science. So that's why he says matter is voidness. That's really far out. Meaning, not just that there's a voidness inside my knuckle banging this floor, but my knuckle banging this floor itself is voidness. And the seeming coarse level hard floor is voidness, and my knuckle is voidness. And they can bang each other because both are void of any non-relational element. So therefore, banging is a way of relating. Do you follow? Yeah. And that's very radical, though, because we feel substance. We feel surrounded by substance. We feel we are substance. But here they're saying substance is voidness.
Is it voidness?
What?
Is it voidness or is it void?
The voidness is just an abstract noun. Don't fuss. I can see you aren't into like fussing. But that's good, actually. I shouldn't say don't. But voidness is just the ta in Sanskrit, you know? Shunya ta. Uh-huh. Shunya means void. So it's both void and voidness. And voidness itself also is void, by the way.
Right. So void, yes.
So never mind. We'll get to that. But the point is, so he's doing the five things first. And then he does with the first of the five. He does this sort of radical thing of saying voidness is matter, matter is voidness. He does it four ways. Voidness is not other than matter. In other words, you don't get inside matter and find a voidness, in other words. Nor is matter other than voidness. You don't sort of leave voidness and find matter. Matter itself is voidness. So this is non-dualistic, right? That's non-duality. This illusory world is the ultimate world, actually. It's just like you know, the reflection in a mirror is the surface of the mirror. It's not something off the surface of the mirror. It's just the surface of the mirror. But that's only an analogy. It's always imperfect. Any verbal analogy or description is imperfect. You have to be aware of. Okay. Likewise, then these sensations, conceptions, mental functions, and consciousnesses are also void. So he doesn't do a four-way thing with the other four mental aggregates or processes. You notice, right? Then he goes, thus all things are voidness, signless. Signless means, you know, when you see the letter A, when you see that the word there on the blackboard there, on the screen there, it automatically seems to pronounce itself to you there. You see the letter T, the T is kind of in the T. You know, you can do an experiment where you take a T and turn it on its side, upside down. When does it stop saying T to you? Which means that we put the sign of T hood in it by our habit. So we don't have to sort of think about it every time. Then it just makes the noise T. Why you feel uncomfortable in a country with Chinese characters on the signs or Russian letters, you know, which everything is a different thing, you know, because it doesn't seem to have an intrinsic significance in it. You follow me? So signless means that all these things that seem to emanate an objective meaning, that's just our creation, actually. Uncreated, unceased, stainless, impeccable, undecreased, and unincreased. Shariputra, thus in voidness, there are no matter, no sensation, no conception, no mental function, no consciousness. Those are the five aggregates. Now he's going to do the 18 sense elements. No eye, no ear, no nose, no tongue, no body, and no mentality. Those are the organs. No form or color, that's the eye object. No sound, the ear object. No scent, the nose object. No taste, the tongue object. No texture, the skin object. No idea, that's the mind object. So those are called the 12 media, sense media, actually, is what they're called. There are no sense media. No, I'm sorry, those are called the 12. Yeah, they are sense media. This next one shouldn't be sense media. There are no sense elements, sorry. There are no sense elements from eye to mentality sense element, because there are 18 of those. And there are no consciousness elements from visual to mental consciousness elements either. And there you add, you have 3%. You have a set of 2%, 12, then you have a set of 3, 18. And the 3 is where you have the organ, the object, and the consciousness that goes through the organ to the object. You know, it's called the 18 dhatus, or elements, and then the ayatanas are the 12 media, which the consciousness goes through. And these are ways, if you meditate on these things, you will find that your sense of a kind of uniform consciousness that you normally go around with, like your consciousness is one thing, it starts to disassemble into all kinds of elements. And you become much more minutely aware of how your mind works. And that's why people, they use these to meditate upon. But here he's going very radical with all of these things, talking to people who have a very strong mindfulness awareness of their inner mental functioning machinery. So they have a map of it. And he is just denying the intrinsic reality of those things. And like, you know, for example, one of the things we strongly feel very intrinsically reality about when we have a powerful emotion. If you're very angry, that feeling of like, that's horrible, you know, like I'm what moves you to, you know, harsh speech or physical action or even mental thought of real annoyance and anger at some object, it feels like an irresistible thing pushing out of your emotional aggregate. You know, and people get whipped around by their inner emotions in that way, right? And so this is sort of dissembling to see all of these things. And then actually that's what mindfulness does, enables you to not react in that way. It's through training yourself to be aware of yourself at this higher degree of mindfulness, of smriti, of remembrance, actually, that means. So there are no ignorance. Then he goes through the 12 links of dependent origination. It's a set of things, which I don't want to take time to explain. No ignorance and no cessation of ignorance. Ignorance being the root of suffering-bound existence, which ignorance is traditional to translate it that way, but really misknowledge is better because it's an active misknowing rather than a failure to know. Is what it's avidya. It's called avidya in Sanskrit, and it's glossed as asatvidya, meaning you know something that's wrong. Do you follow me? You don't think it's wrong. You know it. Like, I know I'm really me or something like that, you know. Especially when I'm hepped up in some way, excited, angry, or I'm very self-righteously convinced I'm right about something, then that's sort of an absolute to me, you see. And I know that's so, you know. And that's a misknowing, because that's only relatively so. It's not absolute. Nothing is absolutely so. We say absolutely about this and that, but that's just a... that's just an emphasis. It's relative, or it wouldn't matter, because it wouldn't relate, if you follow me. Mm-hmm. So, no ignorance, no cessation, no up to old age and death, and no cessation of old age and death. Those are called the 12 links of pratitya samutpada, of relativity or dependent origination. I'm not going to go into it. Then there are the 4 noble truths. There are no suffering, no origination, no cessation. That's nirvana, the cessation of suffering, that means. And no path. No intuitive wisdom, no attainment, but also no non-attainment. That's a really challenging one. Okay? Therefore, the Sariputra, because the Bodhisattva is without attainment, meaning he is not... I once had an argument with one Buddhist who was going around causing a lot of trouble, named not to be even thought of, because he thought he was... He thinks. He, unfortunately, I think he still does. At the time, he thought he was enlightened because he had attained realization of emptiness. But the Bodhisattva, and then I said, but didn't you ever read any Heart Sutra, a big scholar of Buddhism? Anybody who thinks they attained, didn't attain it? What? Where was that? He goes, really? Shows you how people are so amazing. They're so nutty, people. Bodhisattvas without attainment. He lives in reliance on transcendent wisdom. Transcendent wisdom, by the way, prajna paramita, you go beyond having wisdom, you also. You know by being what you know. So you're not sitting there grasping some wisdom. It's a non-dual, no subject-object, it's a non-controlling knowledge. He lives in reliance on transcendent wisdom. Her spirit is unobscured and free of fear. But these guys are free of fear because they're insane and they think they attain something. What can I say? Passing far beyond all confusion, she ultimately succeeds in nirvana. And all the Buddhas who live in past, present, and future rely on, that is to say, once you're enlightened, you're equally in the past and in the future as in the present time. The illusoriness of time you overcome, and you're aware of all future possibilities and all past things that happen. And actually, you can change the past. The past is not fixed. It isn't just the way it was. There's no such thing, according to them. Present and future rely on transcendent wisdom to reach manifestly perfect Buddhahood in unexcelled perfect enlightenment. So that's okay. I don't need to do that. Then, mantra of great science. Vidya means science. The five vidyas are the five sciences. Biology, medicine, linguistics, etc. The Dharma is considered by Buddhists and Hindus and Jains alike what's called the inner science. Adhyatma vidya. The internal, interior science. Science of your mind, of what you're made of what your reality is. And it is science. These modern people who think that materialism only is science, we have to reject them. We have to oppose them. Knowing your mind, its true nature, is a scientific knowledge, not a religious belief. It's an experience. Experiment means experience. It's actually the same thing. It leads to experience. And experience outweighs what David rightly said, 100%. Experience outweighs theory, always. Theory, however, is necessary to get to undistorted experience. That at least that is their experience. Such being so, although there's no final theory. All theory is like hypothetical, useful, perspectival, relational. It's not. There's no absolute dogma except that, which is a negation, which is the negation of emptiness, the negation of that leads to relativity. Okay, then the mantra, the mantra is gate, gate. Gate means gone, and it's in a dative case because you're saluting it. So that's why gate. I put the Y on there because I used to write it just with the G-A-T-E, and then my book was translated into Spanish, and then to my shock, I read, Om puerta, puerta, puerta grande, puerta muy grande, Bodhisattva. So I was shocked, so I put the Y out there just in case. Okay? Om gate gate. So gate means gone. Paragate means super gone. Parasamgate means super totally gone. And then bodhi means enlightenment, awakening. But it's not just awakening. People like to, I don't like enlightenment. That means like 18th century Voltaire and Diderot and Descartes, and I don't want that enlightenment. But actually, that's a good enlightenment. It's just only part of the picture. But it opened the door, actually, to Indian enlightenment reaching these shores, what they learned in the 18th century, and broke them free from the Inquisition where they were all trapped. But awakening, Buddha is defined as Vibuddha and Prabuddha. Vibuddha means awakening from the sleep of misknowledge, but Prabuddha means blossoming into omniscience and compassionate omniscience. So it has a meaning of also something stronger than just awakening. It's also expanding and encompassing, blossoming, literally, prabuddha. And so I therefore stick with enlightenment anyway. Swaha means all is well, or it means all hail. So it's a salutation term. So gate, gate, paragate, parasamgate. And each one, gate is the accumulation path. Simply, there are five things stated there. So that's what's called the accumulation path, where one accumulates learning and merit and knowledge. And then second, gate is the application of that learning path, second path, where one applies that in four stages called warmth, tolerance, summit, and peak of the samsara, something like that. So, heat, peak, like that. It's like four states where you break through into the third path, which is paragate, where you become a noble because you break through a certain degree of self-centeredness where suddenly you are empty enough. You're not yet Buddha, but you're empty enough of your self-centeredness where others' presence becomes as real to you as yourself, which to the ordinary person is like a big theoretical effort, but it's not a cognitive experience for most ordinary persons. Of course, there are a lot of extraordinary persons. But then, since enlightenment is moving in that direction of sort of cognitive altruism, not just moralistic one, but cognitive one, that's paragate, and that's called the vision path, then parasamgate, totally gone, means that's called the meditation path or the realization path, which has 81 levels, where you deepen that insight of the equality of self and other, of your unity and your ability to identify with all other things and feel that you are everything, and you remove 81 different subconscious obstacles to that in the realization path. It's actually called bhavana, which we translate as meditation, which I don't like, because it's from the verb to be, bhavana. It means to make something come to be. Whereas meditation can be a discursive, the type of meditation is discursive thinking. And that this other meditation is going beyond that, and it's like making something real. So realization is really a much better word for it. So the realization path. And then bodhi is the path of no more learning, they call it. The mastery path, and that's where you are enlightened, you become enlightened, and then swaha, all hail. So then he congratulates them, and everybody's happy, and everybody. Mm-hmm. And then always in these things, they always have gods are always present. So don't ever think Buddhism is atheistic. Same in Theravada dualistic Buddhism. The idea that people think that Buddhism is atheistic is totally wrong. They are theistic, but they don't believe in any creator, as I said yesterday. So they're not monotheistic. I call them infinitheistic. Okay. Now, this is like my introduction to things. And now you could ask your question, by the way.
Oh.
Lisa Bundy.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Lisa Bundy Ananda.
There's so many questions.
What is your question?
All right. Really? Should I choose one? Okay. Well, the
that
latest question.
That was your question. Okay. Should I choose one?
What was it?
All right.
Her question was, should I choose one?
I'm going to rattle off a few questions. First question, intrinsic reality.
Well, let's go one at a time. Don't be a hog now.
Okay.
Lisa Bundy Ananda. We don't want to call it Sukara Ananda.
I have a whole lot of like questions about the terminology.
About what?
The terminology, the wording.
Yeah, okay.
Semantics. And then I have a question about the big
picture. Well, what's the question about?
Okay, intrinsic
question?
Reality.
What?
Intrinsic reality.
Yes, okay. What do you think that means? It's the opposite of relational reality. It means that something has a reality just coming out of its own essence.
It has some kind of meaning in and of itself.
That's what it means.
Okay.
And so, for example, there's a wonderful sociology of knowledge, modern sociology has great terms for this kind of thing. There's one term I adore from sociologists of knowledge, people like Peter Berger and Thomas Luckman and so forth. It's called the sense that you have when you see something. You look at your own hand. Actually, there's famous, Wittgenstein had a big debate with G.E. Moore over that, where G.E. Moore is looking at his hand and I know that's my hand. You know, it's like, Wittgenstein says, no, you don't. You're constructing it as a hand, he says. But Moore, no, that's my hand. In other words, when I look at my hand, when you look at your hand, it seems to loom up to you in your cognition with a sense of massive facticity. Massive facticity. Isn't that great? I love that. It's like the floor, big wall. You remember 2010, 2001, you know, Kubrick, the movie?
Yeah.
It was a big black stone hovering there. Oh, the absolute must be. No. But actually, if they're thinking it, it's not absolute. It's relative, you know?
Yeah.
It shows how unconscious we are about our language, that we think that you can say, oh, that's absolute, that big black stone, because that Russian guy went out in his motor scooter there and they disappeared, poof. So the absolute swallowed him. Not absolute. It's relative that swallows you. The absolute cannot relate to the relative. That's an unfortunate problem for monotheistic creator deity theories.
Can the intrinsic relate to the relative? relative?
No, intrinsic is what we think is in things. Intrinsic reality is a hyperbolic concept describing what we think things are into out of our misknowledge. Because why? I have a concept, I learned the word floor. I have a concept for floor or mass effecticity or roof or rock or whatever. And then, because I don't want to go around, you know, naming things for the first time every time I see something newly because it would be cumbersome, it seems to me that the floorness is in the floor. And that's that the floor comes out of its intrinsic reality as floor. And Plato perfectly got it with his idea of the pure idea. He perfectly got that. And he thought it's up in some heaven somewhere and then comes down and instantiates itself in an instant. But basically it's in the heaven of his brain. And the Buddhists completely reject it. A lot of non-Buddhist philosophers like the Vaisheshikas, the Nayayikas in India, not necessarily only the Vedantists or the Yoga Sankhya people, they also thought there was intrinsic reality in things. They didn't like this idea. And because, why? Because you think you're really Lisa. I think I'm really Bob. And it's intrinsic to me. I'm Bob. Don't tell me I'm not Bob. I'm not Lisa. You're not Bob. I go around saying, Bob, you get, oh, no, I'm Lisa. I'm not Bob. You know, you'd have a question about the misterminology. So, but Bob is totally a scribe thing. There's nothing intrinsic. There's no, actually, my students on my office door at Columbia, they found a cartoon about some bird was going, here he comes, Bob, Bob, bobbing along. You know, they think of everything. So, okay, so that's intrinsic reality. And then and there's a thing that Buddhist psychologists have where intrinsic reality corresponds to the level of causation, where we understand things in terms of their causation. Although that itself is a big breakthrough that Western people think happened in Greece 2,500 years ago with the doctors, you know, Hippocrates and Galen. But actually it happened in India with Buddha. And Buddha is celebrated as discoverer of causation rather than some prophet or something, in fact, in India. So that's the level of intrinsic reality. Then intrinsic objectivity is a feeling, that's the mass effecticity one, and that's the level of analysis of things in terms of part and whole. You know, and the quantum physics has gone a long, deep way by analyzing things in terms of part and whole, and they've gotten to where they can't find an indivisible whole. You know, they posit a black hole, but they didn't know quite find that either, because apparently if you find that, you're gone. They their theory, so that gives them an excuse not to find it. And that's that level. That's the second level of subtlety. The third level of subtlety in Buddhist science is the relationship of mind and concept and name to referent. Like what's called the linguistic turn in modern philosophy, that's there from ancient time in Indian philosophy. You know, when you meet yoga, you're a yogini. The reason you like yoga, and you met yoga because by meeting yoga, you met a higher culture than this Euro-American culture. That's why we like yoga. They understand their own bodies and minds better than those gringos. Even in New York, not only in Texas, even in London, everywhere. You know, the Mediterranean was not the middle of the earth. It was a far-flung part of Eurasia, relatively backward, right? More militaristic, violent, less tolerant of nonconformity and so forth, more authoritarian. Anyway, that's an important thing to remember in trying to learn these things, because we do have all this, you know, this thing, okay? So, Buddha scientist's key discovery. We have, hold the next question, okay, Lisa, we'll come back. We have the world totally upside down. We think that relative reality is absolute. We think your question might be answered as we go through this. We think we are absolute, that our rigid self-identity is the real us, that it opposes a world absolutely other to us. You know, that we are just absolutely different from everything else, and that is an obviously losing situation which produces suffering, because me, the real Bob, you, the real Lisa, the real David, the real whoever it is, facing vast infinite others, lose, cannot overcome them. He investigated this bad situation and found that we were in error, actually mortal error, that's the death error, actually. That the fixed separate self is an illusion, he found. that in reality we are free of self-identity, i.e., that we're not free of identities. We have relational, changeable identities, but we're free of a fixed identity, I should say, to make it more clear, of any non-relational, intrinsically real, fixed self. Although ultimate selflessness can be called supreme self of selflessness, nayatmiya paramatma. So they can use paramatma language too, just like the Vedantins do, which some religions less helpfully call immortal and immaterial soul, as if there was an unchanging kind of dog tag, barcode, essential you in there, essential Bob in there, and then that's immortal and it's kept forever there, blah, blah, blah. And that there is no such thing, according to the Buddha. Supporting a self-defeating delusion of an isolated core identity. Realizing his freedom from such an unreal psychosis-causing separate selfhood, he enjoyed the release of his relative self, which was imprisoned under trying to be an absolute self, whereas actually it's relational, interconnected with everything, and the difference of self and other, therefore, is not an absolute thing. It's there, it's sort of arbitrary almost. He realized experiential, infinite interconnection with all life, beings, and things, feeling reality's freedom, bliss as theirs, as much as his. That's the reality of voidness relativity, yeah, which is blissful, apparently, is felt ultimately as blissful. Yeah, because of this, the real stress and suffering comes from that maintaining a separateness, an artificial separateness that is actually based on an unreal sense of core that separateness is grounded in, which isn't there. Yet not ignoring the air that others have, and it's still your change if it doesn't change them, so not ignore that they're in error and they are entrapped, therefore, in suffering, which then makes you, by being one with them and then feeling their suffering, that you have inevitable universal compassion. And then he has these, they divide the presence of such a being into what's called reality body, dharma. Here dharma has its highest meaning, of which is reality itself. Sambhogakaya, it means a beatific or bliss, thorough bliss body. And nirmana means an emanation body, where you manifest out of wherever it is to help every being, whatever the beings want, you do that, supposedly. It's a very extravagant idea of the power of the loving, enlightened beings in the universe, the gurus, the buddhas, etc. It's a very, very, that they are very omnipresent is a very powerful Mahayana Buddhist idea, and holds us all in the gentle, diverse mandala of liberative education. So then the problem with this experience that Buddha had, I mean, the good news of it is that he found that freedom, and he felt our problem of not having that freedom, and he realized that since he had been like us, we could also come to understand our reality, but believing in it won't do it. You have to understand it. You have to realize it. You have to know it. So therefore, it's science-based. His discovery is science-based. It's not religion-based. He didn't meet God who said, I'll save them all, just tell them to believe in me. He did not. He met God, and God said, I don't know what's going on. Please help me out. Help me help them. Now, I like them. I didn't create them, but, you know, I'm stronger than they are. I like to help them. Brahma, that was. And the other gods, same. So he was free by wisdom knowledge, wisdom intuition, intuitive wisdom. So can we be. And the first step of that is what's called realistic worldview, which is basically, it isn't believing in Buddha. It isn't believing that my absolute self that I feel in there is not true. Just believing that won't help me get rid of the feeling, in other words. In fact, to get rid of it, I have to admit to myself, I have to find it in myself. In other words, I have to find the root of when I lose my temper, I go bang a wall with my head, which means that I act as if I was absolute. You know, like I'm not a relative head that's going to break itself on the wall. Because that emotion seems to come from that absolute place. So one has to sort of find that one has a feeling of it and then really go to investigate it. That's the procedure. So like, for example, in that Upanishad, I forgot which one, where Indra is being asked by the Rishi, or I can't remember, is this yourself, is that yourself, is the other self? And he keeps saying, this is myself, and that is myself. And the guy keeps going, not iti, not, not. The other guy who was interrogating him, and I forget, it's Bharadvaja or something, I can't remember who's the characters. It might be Yama who's asking him. And he keeps, you know, negating that sense of self, going deeper and deeper, you know. And then finally he comes up to some Parama Atma that's outside of the whole thing, which is one of the tendencies that can happen to one. So realistic worldview. But the belief is a belief in realistic worldview, embrace of causation. Because why is that so? That's the realistic worldview. Because of the fact that according to these psychologists, we have this place inside ourselves that we feel is this unchanging core essence that is not actually affected by causation. That is sort of not connected to anything. And when things become painful for us, we want to withdraw into it. And like the way we get very attached to it, because we think that's where we're going to escape to, this very painful world. You know, and those Brahmins that Buddha was talking to and why he taught them dualistic Buddhism, and those Brahmins who Patanjali was talking to, who wanted to chittavritti nirodha, they wanted to stop that turning of the mind which was ruminating over all the suffering, klishta, you know, kleshas, stuck in them, if addicted to them. Teaching them that because there's some place they want to withdraw into. So the acceptance that everything is causal, as far as whatever one can experience in a way, is an acceptance of the one's full embeddedness in relativity in a subtle way. Although even though one just accepting of that or having a worldview about it doesn't automatically enable one to experiencing it to the gut level, which means experiencing freedom from any isolated self. It doesn't happen that easily.